And good morning, Natasha Mitchell, joining you for the next hour of your day here on ABCRN at a fresh week of Life Matters landing, well, to help you nourish your week, we hope. Valet Oliver Sacks, one of the greats, neurologist, writer, man of heart and mind, a wonderful, compassionate, intelligent storyteller, wasn't he? Oliver Sacks was one of the key inspirations that drove my creative decade here on RN, bringing you All in the Mind each week, and his legacy will certainly live on in my mind. And I'm sure Robin Williams will probably replay one of the fabulous interviews he did on stage with Oliver Sacks over on The Science Show, which, by the way, celebrated 40 years on air with Robin Williams this past weekend. Did you catch him replaying show number one from August 1975? What a listen it was, and so surreal and striking when you think of many of the biggest ecological debates that he was covering in that very first show back in 1975. Echo many of the exact same debates that define our times. Well worth catching up with on the Science Show website. So a hearty happy birthday to The Science Show and to Robin Williams, who has been a big mentor in my broadcast career as a science journalist. But on Life Matters today, we're going to be joined by two rock and roll greats, Deborah Conway and Rebecca Barnard, because Meryl Streep stars as a rock and roll star. Yes, Meryl Streep. Donning the leathers, she learnt guitar for the role. It's her new film, Ricky and the Flash, and it raises all sorts of provocative issues about women in the music industry. So I'm going to be joined by Deborah Conway and Rebecca Barnard to talk Meryl, music and motherhood this morning. Let's squeeze in some of your calls from last week. On Friday, we had Daniel Handler, he of Lemony Snicket fame and acclaim, and he joined us to talk kids' books and reading, along with Australian children's authors Gretel Colleen and Hazel Edwards. Here's a call.
Struggled with reading. I was a very poor reader. I hated reading. But when I was about 11 or 12, my dad gave me Conan the Barbarian books, and they gripped me. I was enthralled, this world of rape and pillage and fighting and battles. And then he moved me on to all sorts of science fiction books, so the Anne McCaffrey dragon books, Ursula Le Guin, all those things, and I got captivated into these other worlds, which turned me into a great reader, and I still read now, and I even go back to some of those books now 30 years later. Thanks.
Thank you. I love that it was Conan the Barbarian that hooked you into reading. And you mentioned Ursula Le Guin, and I had this really inspired Year 12 teacher in English who gave us Ursula Le Guin as our study texts. And wow, what a woman she is too. Speaking of school, last week we looked at the Victorian government's decision to remove special religious instruction from within school hours. So they're the classes taught by volunteers from different faith groups. It was a very robust discussion we had with three guests and you. Here are some calls.
Hello, this is Phoebe calling from Canberra. I feel it's imperative now, considering how disenfranchised society is, that children have the opportunity to learn a faith-based system in their education. Why? Because of the sense of mystery and the mystical which that provides, and that, I feel, is what children today need. Obviously, it needs to have a more current application. The religion which I was taught at an Anglican school in Victoria certainly was not useful, but the morality tales of which religion is full absolutely are essential to children today.
Georgie Stubbs from Mount Martha, previously a CRE teacher in local schools, which I very much loved, but I absolutely applaud the Victorian government's decision, which will enable all students, hopefully, to learn about all the different faiths which have as their basic tenet, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And once people learn that this tenet, the golden rule, is the basic tenet of all the different religious faiths that will help to lead to understanding and harmony.
My name is Jason. I'm from Sydney. I'm a special religious education teacher. I support what the kids' parents are teaching them at home. That's what I do for roughly 30 minutes a week. I am teaching them from the Bible. I'm teaching them Christian ethics. The taxpayers of Australia are looking to special religious education teachers to teach their kids the values and the lessons that they are learning at home during the week. Family life, community, yes, God. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jason. And you can catch up with that whole discussion on the Life Matters website. Just look at last week's program and you can listen to the audio there. And, of course, you can subscribe to us using the ABC Radio app. TV presenter Jessica Rowe also joined me last week and spoke very candidly about her experience of postnatal depression. She described it in great detail. We got a big response. Here's a message we got on the website. Louise writes, immense thanks to Jessica. Her experience with postnatal depression was a mirror image of my own. Huge respect that she has had the courage to share that experience in detail. Even though I too have recovered, I feel less alone today and less ashamed knowing that a, quote, together woman like Jessica went through similar. Bless you, powerful, wonderful woman. And here's a call also.
One of the terrible things that has happened is the federal government cutting the funds for the prenatal support to help people cope with postnatal depression. And Susan Lee, when she announced it, said that that was a state matter, regardless of how many women commit suicide or feel as this woman has felt. The federal government shows no interest at all in what is a national concern, not merely state by state concern. Thank you so much for this program.
And it's our pleasure. And you can leave a message on anything you're hearing. Our listener feedback line, 24 hours a day, 02-833-1430, 02-833-1430. And tweet us too, at RN Life Matters. We'd love to hear from you today. Look, it's a tough call to find Australia's Father of the Year. There are millions of you out there. But that's what the Australian Father's Day Council and the Shepherd Centre does each year. And this morning they've announced Sydney-based general practitioner Dr. Jamal Rifi as the 2015 Australian of the Year. Of course, Australia's Muslim community is diverse, but Dr. Rifi's voice is a strong one, often heard on issues affecting his diverse community. He's currently in Lebanon visiting his family, where it's well and truly past midnight, but he's kindly stayed up for us, and we welcome him to Life Matters. Jamal Rifi, congratulations, and thanks for joining us on ABC Radio National.
Many thanks, and thank you for having me on the show.
You and your wife, Lana, have five children. How does it feel to be named Australian Father of the Year?
To be honest, when I received the call about my nomination, I had mixed feeling. Humbled even to be nominated, but to be awarded such an accolade and award, it means a lot to me, especially at this time of my life, when at one time over the last year or so, I did question my role as a father. And for my kids to nominate me, it's just telling me that I did the right thing by, you know, voicing my concern and also voicing my opposition against the so-called Islamic State, even though that I did receive some threat. And that's why I did question my role as a father. I was supposed to protect them rather than to pose a threat to them.
And you felt that speaking out about IS did compromise your family's safety?
Look, definitely, we had to take some precaution because we took that threat very seriously. And I felt if the whole of Australia is concerned about the lone wolf attack, and unfortunately, I live among some of these wolves, and I've increased my security at home. Mm. And taken every precaution, spoke with my kids, and they said, no, we have to be public about this because this is stigmatizing our religion, and also it's brutalizing and dehumanizing that the religion that we believe in. And it's important for someone like me to voice the real views about this so-called Islamic State.
Well, they've obviously taken a cue from you in their lives, watching you in your role as a leader in and around your community. Take me back 28 years ago. What was life like for you when you first became a parent? You were a medical student, I gather?
Yes, that's true. I was at Sydney University in my third year medical degree. And it was very nice to be a father. But nevertheless, I was also immersed in my studies. Mm. Lana was working full-time as a school teacher. And it wasn't easy.
You had left the conflict in Lebanon to study. In fact, you did your medical degree twice, I gather, once in Romania in a foreign language to you, and again in Australia in English. And then on top of that comes fatherhood.
Well, I did half of my medical degree in Romania because I just didn't like the system. I didn't like the ethos of medicine in the once communist Romanian. And I had to leave, came to Australia, and I got married. And the reasons why, because I was in love with my wife, and I felt the sacrifice is worth it. And to be honest, it is the best decision I have ever made in my life, is to get married and to live in Australia.
Mm. How closely, thinking about your own approach to fatherhood, how closely did it resemble your parents' approach, your own father's approach, for example?
Look, I definitely learned from my parents the way they approached fatherhood, but also at the same time, I was aware of the shortfall that they have done. Like every father's and every parents, they do things right, they do things wrong, and it's important for their kids to learn from the right and wrong, to build on the right and to disregard the wrongs. And I felt that my father did an extremely good job on me and on my other kids, but the strength that was in my mother. And the same way, I would say that my family, the biggest role was played by my wife, Lana, herself. But I also acknowledge now, to be honest, the fact that she did help me in my fatherhood. And such a an award to be received right now does acknowledge the important role fathers have in their children's life. And if I may, just to say that the fact that the Shepherd Center and what they do in terms of helping hearing affected people, young people, early in their life, and to be teamed up with the fathers, the Australian fathers of the
Father's Day Council. Yes,
it's actually, it works quite well, because it says to me and to all our listeners that fathers play an important role in their kids early in life, in the same way the Shepherd Centers play an important role in hearing affected young people, to give them a voice so they can learn how to speak.
Fathers play an important role in their children's lives. Children play an important role in their fathers' lives. How has being a father changed you, shaped you, defined you?
In a big way, to be honest, because I've always worked and strived to be a role model for my kids. But at the same time, right now, they all adults. I enjoy their my discussion with them. I enjoy their views and our differences of opinion. But at the same time, there is a tremendous respect for each other's points of view. And our love is unconditional.
Mm. Well, I mean, you've being awarded Australian Father of the Year gives you full license to boast about your children. Father of five impressive sounding adults now. One of them, one of your sons, works alongside you in your medical practice as a registered nurse. What are your children up to?
Well, each one of them is successful in what they want to do And my eldest, Faisal, as you said, is a registered nurse. And I have the pleasure of working alongside with him in my practice. My eldest daughter is a criminologist, and she works in one of the local Muslim women association. And also I've got my daughter Shaza, she's 24, and she is a civil engineer working also with in a construction company. And Sue is 18, first year at university to become a teacher. And the youngest one just sitting for his HSC exam wants to be jihad, and he wants to be a film producer.
Ha, fantastic. You're a practicing Muslim. To what extent did your faith inform your particular approach to parenthood?
Look, definitely the morality of any faith, to be honest. It emphasizes the importance of family as a nucleus of society. And successful family, it means to successful society. And I believe religion.
Have we lost you? It looks like we've lost Jamal Rifi. We've just been talking to the Australian Father of the Year, Dr. Jamal Rifi. He is a Sydney-based general practitioner. He's been a voice in the Australian media, in public life, very vocal voice on various issues that affect his community. Of course, the Muslim community is a diverse community, so he's just one voice. But in the past year, he's been very outspoken about Islamic State and the IS and the radicalisation of young people. And speaking out is a very tough thing to do. And as you heard from Jamal, he was reflecting on the impact that it's had on his family. Jamal Rifi is Australian Father of the Year. We'll just see if we can get him back on the line.
He throws a manila folder down on the desk. Across the top it's wanted, and underneath a photo of a man and a woman. And he says, do these people live in the apartment next to mine?
The Moth. True stories told live. This week, your typical guy next door helps the FBI arrest his neighbour. America's most wanted criminal. For real. That's The Moth, Saturday nights at 7, right here on RN.
Just prior to his directorial debut, actor-writer Joel Edgerton found inspiration on a psychologist's wall.
Behind him, he had a boomerang on the wall, and I said, have you been to Australia? Is that what that's there for? He said, no, that's there to remind me that everything we say and everything we do will at some point circle back and come back to you.
The Gift is a compelling thriller and one of the best first feature films of an Australian director in recent memory. Before seeing the film, just look for the Final Cut podcast on the RN homepage.
And we're talking to Dr. Jamal Rifi, the Australian Father of the Year, just named this morning. Welcome back. Sorry we lost you there.
That's quite all right.
Look, just interested in your own story as well. In recent years, yes, you've been outspoken on a number of issues you feel very strongly about, particularly the radicalisation of young Muslim teens in Australia. You've also, though, taken a very active role, Jamal, in promoting Australia's diverse culture overseas. Tell us about taking an Australian Aboriginal dance group to Lebanon.
Definitely, as a Australian, I wanted to showcase the Australian culture and the Aboriginal culture. And in 2004, I did sponsor a group of Aboriginal dancers, Komori Dance Group, to Lebanon. And we did that twice in 2004 and 2009. And the Lebanese authority and the Lebanese people never seen or heard about an Aboriginal dance group, and they dubbed them the Red Indian of Australia. And it was very successful in my view because it did showcase them the Aboriginal culture itself.
Well, I think, though, didn't it also lead to an interesting new dance form?
Look, definitely. it just happened. There was a team effort between the Aborigines that were in Lebanon and some of the belly dancers, and they clicked together And they did make a show where they combined the Aboriginal music with the belly dancing. And it was something magical, to be honest. No one seen it before. And when we have belly dancers joining the Aboriginal group and dancing together, and something to me, it was very spiritual, to be honest.
What a wonderful combination, too. Let's come back to some of the issues you've been outspoken about, Jamal. The former Immigration Minister, now Social Services Minister, Scott Morrison, has complimented you as always someone who acts his words. He said that in the context of your contribution to Australia's discussion on the radicalisation of young people, that's been his comment. Do you think as a nation we are winning back the hearts and minds of young people at risk, or are we way off doing that?
No, we definitely have turned the corner. We are much better now than what we were 1 or 1.5 years ago. First of all, I can report from the Australian Muslims community at large, there is a huge support for the fact that we are Australian, and at the same time, nobody right now condone what's been happening overseas. Their stand against the so-called Islamic State is almost unanimous across all the section of my community, because they were able to see through the fogginess that they have created, and they are able to differentiate between their rhetoric and their action. Their action is nothing but barbaric, and unfortunately, their propaganda was so sleek, and they were targeting our young people, and mainly vulnerable people. And our community have realized that the school kids, teenagers, vulnerable people, they have been used through that propaganda to sneer them into such an ideology.
But do you
take
think,
them away from, yeah.
Do you think necessarily, though, they are targeting young people? I mean, social media can be, you know, is accessed by all young people. Just recently we've seen 7 young Australians apparently stopped at Sydney Airport, believed to be on their way to join terrorists overseas. Is that in itself is an indication that we need to be doing much more, surely?
Well, look, let me clarify this. I'm quite aware about the case of the 5 young people who were stopped at the airport. Stopping at the airport doesn't mean they are going to join the terrorist state at all. And let me clarify, I'm quite aware of what's been happening. Definitely, the authority, they felt the right and they need to stop them. But it doesn't mean they are joining the Islamic State. I believe right now there is no support whatsoever for such an ideology, except for people who have troubled mind, who are naive, or somehow they have their mental illness, or the sheer fact they are stupid. What's for them to take such a decision?
It seems to be complex, though, and thinking back to your role after the Cronulla riots in 2005, you really worked to rebuild a sense of shared community in Cronulla by, in fact, starting a course that trained young Muslim men and women to become surf lifesavers. It was a sort of genius idea, and I wonder if we need another genius idea like that to capture kids in the community who are disaffected on racial and religious lines.
Definitely, unfortunately, the Australian Muslims communities public image is not as good as it's supposed to be. And unfortunately, most people who read about us as a community, they feel that we are alienated or different. But in reality, we are not. We are the same as, and we have the same aspiration as any other Australian. And the best way, unfortunately, always the spotlight in the media is about everything negative that is happening in the community. So that's why I felt it's very important to open our door, let people come to us and meet us and interact with us. And at the same time, we interact with them. And then they will realize what's been written in the media, which is most of it, let's say, it is based on real events. but unfortunately blown out of proportion. And also, the a lot of our community who are eccentric in their view or in their opinion, and they being given the spotlight. And that's why I felt as a moderate voice in my community, we should also speak our mind out, because if we don't, we create a vacuum where the extremists, the intolerant, and also the people who they have dubious agenda, they will be given a platform to speak their mind.
Well, today the platform was yours as Australian Father of the Year, and we congratulate you. We thank you for staying up so late there in Lebanon where you're spending time with your family. Dr. Jamal Rufi, thank you and congratulations.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Australian Father of the Year, Sydney-based general practitioner Dr. Jamal Rufi, 2015. Australian Father of the Year. On Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you. We're getting musical next. Music can enliven us. It can also bring comfort. Last year I spoke to therapeutic harpist Alison Ware. She can be found strumming her strings beside hospital beds. Well, this morning a chance to meet another harpist, Peter Roberts, who also happens to be Australia's only fully qualified music thanatologist. Heard of one of those? He uses a particular approach called a music vigil to bridge the gap between life and death. Music thanatology, it's a subspecialty of palliative care, and we were curious to find out more. And as you'll hear, Peter is also changing lives at the other end of life. He works with kids as well. Reporter Joel Carnegie met him out on the ward for Life Matters.
We've got little Jake here in his mum's arms. He's got a little blue beanie on, which is very, very cute. There's a tradition in the hospital. I brought this notion to the hospital of playing the Brahms lullaby whenever a baby's born. They broadcast it throughout the hospital just to let everybody know something nice has happened. So I might start with a live version of Brahms lullaby. He'll recognise it one day.
Today we're at the St John of God Hospital in Geelong, and this is Peter Roberts. Peter plays live music for the patients at the hospital, and right now we're in the special care nursery.
The instrument I use is the harp, or the instrument we all use is the harp and voice, and I always say silence, they add silence to that. So harp, voice and silence. I don't think he needs anything from me. He looks so peaceful there, doesn't he? How's he doing? Yeah, is he beautiful? Yeah.
The nurses also keep a watchful eye for the babies who are in this particular section, as they're not quite able to cope in the big wide world yet, including this little one.
As I'm playing, this little one is very, very, very still. But, you know, it takes a while for them to start to be affected by the music.
According to Peter's research, it takes about 8.5 minutes.
So I just keep playing. I'm just trying to wait till... Just to connect. I can see a little mouth is moving. She's very still.
For nurses Donna and Helen, having Peter in the room takes the edge off the high-stakes stress that can sometimes be felt in this particular ward.
I'm playing in a different register.
And I think the parents really appreciate having, you know, the music and the harp, because it's beautiful to listen to. Yeah. So, and it does have an effect on the babies. They tend to really calm down, and you can see that in their heart rate and their respiratory rate. So it's pretty special, really. Often you'll see husbands in here too, Pete, and you probably don't notice it, but they kind of wipe a little tear away from their eye.
The hospital has also seen some remarkable patient responses to Peter's music.
There was a baby who was really struggling, and it had a couple of very serious circumstances. He had been throwing up, and I played, and he was able to settle, and he was able to feed again. Good things happened when I played for this little fellow. And eventually, that little one, little boy, did go home. I phoned the mother, and I said, "How's he going?" And she said, "He's not doing all that well, really. And we've also found out that he's deaf." Isn't that something? So now we're going down into another area of the hospital. It's a palliative care section. And I'll need to check in with the nurse unit manager to see if she has anybody that she'd like me to play for. So if we can find her, I'll have a look.
Peter is Australia's only music thanatologist. As a form of musical palliative care, music thanatology is a prescriptive musical experience more common in the United States that aims to assist and comfort a person who is dying.
And the whole point of the playing is to lead people into a comfortable container of silence, which sounds odd when you're playing an instrument, but that's the nature of it. It's wonderful to have something of value to offer when nothing else can be done. At some stage, we are going to die, and it's a privilege in many ways to be able to, you know, to be in a room and comfort that person who is letting go of their life.
Sorry, it was worth a try.
I don't see the death as a dreadful thing. You know, sometimes I think it's a blessing, and it's the natural thing. And so, I guess I'm the one to be there with them, and I'm trying to mirror back non-verbally through the music perhaps feelings they may have or the needs that they may have, so that I'm the one that's sort of accompanying them. I'm travelling with them.
Peter collects his thoughts, his harp, and gets ready to play.
My aim is for this to be very low key. I don't arrive, you know, with a grand harp and you know, and sit in the middle and perform. It's a pity that the instrument is a harp in many ways, because it draws attention to itself. So that's my skill, I guess, is to not create a fuss, to blend in, to be by the bedside. I sort of start in silence in a way, you know. I speak to the person no matter what, and then I just begin to play.
We sit in the corridor and watch the passing parade of doctors, nurses, patients and family members go by. It was in this position, in the corridor, where Peter's work was to have a profound and unexpected impact on Paul and his unwell wife, Jill.
We thought Jill was going to be okay. We thought we would have Christmas with her, and things took a turn for the worse on the Thursday, and we were all here, and all of a sudden, I didn't know, nor did we request it, but this extraordinary man set up his harp right outside our door, and those sounds just made sense. They made sense to the moment that we were experiencing, this very sacred moment, and the sounds also seemed to put in perspective all the other sounds that we were hearing, the hospital sounds, the trolleys, the everything else, the traffic. It just, I guess we were in a world of our own. The vigil itself is quite extraordinary. It just happens in the most beautiful, spiritually sensitive way that I was in awe of, and I thought humanity needs to really know this. Jill passed away on the Friday, very peacefully, and I just thank Peter and want to honour him because of the gift and the honour that he gave to her as a caregiver.
A couple of years ago, the hospital, in conjunction with Deakin University, completed several research projects into Peter's work with infants and those who were dying. The hospital tracked the progress of those who experienced Peter's music, particularly confirming the observations made by Peter and the nursing staff regarding the effect on babies. But the research into Peter's work in palliative care also supported anecdotal responses, indicating, quote, "The genuine presence of the musician and the prescriptive nature of the music creates a safe environment for reverence, peace and tranquility for people to do their own work of unbinding and leave-taking.
To move from music into silence. Silence isn't necessarily blank. We're in a silent room, but I can hear. It's a mystery, none of us know, but for me, it's not so much a belief, as like I almost feel as though I know that place already. And I think that we go home to magnificent silence, and it's a fine place to go to.
And that's Peter Roberts, Australia's only fully qualified music thanatologist. He was speaking to Joel Carnegie for Life Matters, and he runs a not-for-profit charity called the Institute of Music in Medicine, and we've put the details on the Life Matters website so you can look at that and the ways in which he's fundraising for his work. And Life Matters is where you are. We're continuing the musical theme. We're going to meet two rock goddesses next on Life Matters.
Friday, 5:30. It's a great time to catch up on popular culture on the radio, right? Oh, well, if you absolutely can't be there, the good news is RN's pop culture show The List is now online and on mobile. It's everything you never knew you needed to know. The List, available anytime, in your mind all the time. Hear, hear. Download the ABC Radio app now.
Have you caught Meryl Streep's new movie, Ricky and the Flash, yet?
Whoa, Mom, you're here. Like the 80s all over again.
We're practically eloping, Mom.
Why don't you be honest, Josh, and just tell Mom that you don't want her at the wedding?
Someone order a mudslide.
I've missed so much.
There was a hole in this family, and I filled it.
They're all grown up now.
You think because you screwed up once you don't get a second chance?
That I hate to lose.
Hey!
Why did you walk out on my daughter?
Our daughter.
Julie hates you.
That may be. And I have to live with that every day of my life, but now you have to live with the pain you caused.
It really doesn't matter if the kids love you or not. It's not their job to love you.
It's your job to love them.
Call in sick. Go to the old neighborhood.
Sometimes a girl just needs her mother. Lots of things are going to change in your life.
Someday you're going to wake up and find a gray hair.
And I don't mean on your head.
Oh, I relate to that last comment. I want to get lost in the rock and roll and drift away. Can we do that on a Monday morning? Do I have your permission? Okay, see ya. Meryl Streep does that in her new role in Ricky and the Flash, just released in cinemas across the country. This is Meryl playing a rock goddess. Tight leathers, black coal eyes, even the very 80s side hair plaits kind of work, I have to say. She's convincing as Ricky Randazzo, a musician, a mother. And this is where the tension really lies for her character, her choice to pursue her art and a life on the road playing gigs, apparently at the expense of her relationships with her now adult children. Meryl's real-life daughter plays one of them. Reviewers have remarked that the film turns the old rock star trope on its head, the Mick Jagger figure chasing his dreams, leaving behind a trail of women, mothers, kids behind him, and getting away with it because male music sex symbols can do that. But what happens if a woman does the same? Now, that's Ricky's story. Joining me this morning, two well-known women of Australian rock, Deborah Conway, who came, of course, to fame as lead singer of the 80s band Do Re Mi, and Rebecca Barnard, who headed up Rebecca's Empire in the late 90s. Both are still in the business, going strong, and they join us in the Melbourne studio together. Good morning.
And getting away with it, Natasha.
And getting away with it.
Hello.
Oh,
good morning. Hello. Good morning, listeners.
Deb, you saw the film this weekend. What do you make of Meryl's character, Ricky? Is she convincing?
Meryl Streep is always fantastic, I think, no matter what she does. I'm a huge Meryl fan. Mm. But and she was convincing. Once again, she was very convincing as Ricky Randazzo. But I have to say the film left me wondering why they bothered to make it, to be honest. I didn't like it at all.
Yeah, elaborate. What gave you the shits?
Sure.
so to speak.
Well, I did turn to my husband halfway through and went, what is this film about? I couldn't figure it out. It was very disjointed. And I think they spent far too long kind of being worshipful of the band itself, which is, you know, Meryl Streep's a wonderful actor, but she's not a musician. And this was very, very much Jonathan Demme being in love with rock and roll and, you know, 70s rock. And I don't think it didn't really work because it didn't kind of translate as being incredible, gripping music to listen to. So that I found a bit disappointing. And I guess, you know, for me, there was just too many holes in the plot, like why this woman, you know, midway through her life, who's, you know, obviously he's gotten married to a, you know, you'd have to say one of the more appealing characters in the film, who was played by Kevin Kline, her husband, who seemed like he was going to be a pretty supportive guy. And then she decides that she'd rather go and live a rock and roll life in LA, far away from her three children that she's given birth to. But it just didn't quite make sense, because unlike Mick Jagger or, I don't know, Ray Davies or whoever, whatever rock god icon you want to pick out, she wasn't that successful. She wasn't sending home buckets of money to, you know, put her. She was, you know, bankrupt, and
she's a tragic figure.
So, but why not? But why not do both? Why not? You know, I think that motherhood and being a musician are two of the easiest things to combine. Not unlike that film portrayed. They don't have to be at odds with each other.
Well, and this is the premise of the film, that they are at odds with each other. Rebecca, you haven't seen the film yet, but let's explore that main premise, pitting mother versus music career. And Ricky's cry of angst at one point is, two dreams, can't a woman have two dreams? Rebecca, can they have two dreams? Are there tensions implicit there?
I think, of course, they can. I know we're talking about music specifically now, but I think women generally, whatever job they're doing, there's always that wrench. You know, should I be putting the child in crèche? Should I be a stay-at-home mother? All that stuff. It comes up with every woman I've ever known. Mother guilt is huge, no matter what you're doing. But like Deborah said, you can do both. You can have two dreams. I mean, having a baby, it's not like having a dream. It's it's a real reality. It's probably the realest thing you'll ever do, you know. And it's if you don't like it, it's too bad.
Oh, you've got a son, Harry, 19, and you play with him now sometimes. But when he arrived, what shifted for you in terms of your music career?
It was really interesting for me because the timing was quite bizarre. It's almost like the day I realised I did the test and said, "Ooh, I'm preggers." Seriously, that's that almost to the day, that's when Triple J picked up our first single.
Oh, God.
So everything.
The timing.
Yeah, which was really, I mean, it was exciting. Great. It was exciting. And then as it progressed and then he was born, and that's when I was at the peak, or the band was at its peak of popularity. So it was sort of like two births in one, if you know what I mean. And I have to say, I think Deborah might agree, if I didn't have family support like my mother and my sister, I would have found it a lot harder. So, but I had really good support.
So what did that mean in terms of life on the road with Rebecca's Empire at the time?
It meant Mum was in the back of the Tarago changing nappies.
It's really when you want your mother the most, isn't it?
It is.
And suddenly you think, oh, Mum.
Yeah.
I adore you. Come, spend a lot of time with me.
And you did it for us. You know, all that sort of full circle stuff.
Deborah Conway, go on, Rebecca.
No, it was fun. It was really fun having Mum, Nana in the back, sort of making everyone laugh. She's quite irreverent, but look, I loved it. I enjoyed it, but I was lucky. I was lucky in that I had a record that got airplay and I could get people at gigs, and I had a beautiful baby boy.
You've got three daughters, Deb.
And, I do.
And I wonder how you navigated that tension between home life and life on the road?
I don't know that we had a lot of tension, not until later anyway. I mean, when Sid was 3.5 months, my first daughter was 3.5 months old, we actually moved to London for a few years, and which was probably one of the stupidest things I've done. Although I have done
numbers of
stupid things.
Just add another element of chaos in your life.
That was a pretty crazy
move away from your family.
Time.
That was a crazy, stupid thing to do.
What happened?
What happened?
Yeah.
Well, we found ourselves over the other side of the world, adrift from, you know, all immediate family and trying to write a new album, pretty much adrift from the record company at that point too, because the shooting party had been in just the week before we arrived and sort of sacked half the staff because they'd been overspending on Peter Andre's single. Anyway, great histories.
That was a canny investment of theirs.
Very canny. And so, you know, so anyway, I found, curiously enough, it quite difficult to be trying to be inventive and staring at the blank piece of paper trying to write songs while I'm breastfeeding and exhausted. Mm. But finally we managed to do it. We made one of the most depressing records that we've ever made. It was called My Third Husband. It was a very late night record, shall we say, Natasha. And then and we made the record, and then we came back to Australia, much to my mother's relief. And I had two more daughters after that. But, you know, Sid was young enough, and they were all young enough for a while to just sort of bring them all on the road. And Willie and I, that's my husband and the father of my daughters, play together. So, you know, we were able to, you know, just kind of pack everybody up and either bring my mother or my sister or a nanny or whatever. And for a time that worked until they were school age and not so easy to move, at which point it was easier to get another guitar player than it was another father.
So you'd go off on the road.
Willie stayed at home, and I'd go on the road because obviously I'm Deborah Conway's harder to replace.
Yeah.
Anyway, but you had to.
But that's the power of your particular partnership, isn't it? That at different times he stepped back and was at home while you toured.
Yeah, and I think he enjoyed that anyway. Mm. I know he did.
You're lucky.
I am lucky.
You are lucky.
I chose well.
And you did choose well. And, you know, just listening, reflecting, we're making it sound like it was a breeze. By no means it was a breeze, was it?
No, it was. But
it was constant. Like, sorry, I'll just remind you of when you and I played in Mount Gambier once.
And that's right.
Touring together with kids in tow, yeah?
Well, one little, Deborah's youngest, Hetty.
It was Hetty, wasn't
it? Yeah, and you kept saying, and we left her with a babysitter in some weird sort of 60s motel while we went off to do the gig, and all the way to the gig, Deborah was going, now, look, if you were a babysitter and a kid was screaming and just would not stop, how long do you think you could last before you shook it or, you know, did something? And I was trying to be really diplomatic, and I was going, oh, 2 or 5 hours, and she's going, no, we won't be away 5 hours, we'll be away about 3 hours. And I said, yep, you could tolerate it for 3 hours.
I've forgotten that. That's good. She was a bit of a screamer, Hetty, so, in the early days.
Rebecca Barnard and Deborah Conway are with us on the occasion of Meryl Streep playing Ricky in Ricky and the Flash. She plays a rock and roll star whose life on the road has compromised her relationship with her children. It's an interesting sort of trope they're exploring, and I'm also interested in how they reflect, how they represent an ageing rock and roll star. I mean, you think of Emmylou Harris and Lucinda Williams, Chrissy Hynde, Blondie, Bonnie Raitt. I mean, so many women are rocking on, but are women allowed to age on stage in the way that men are, Deb?
Well, the list that you've just mentioned as stellar examples of people who have been incredibly successful at lengthening their career out way past menopause. So, you know, I don't think we've got a problem there. There's always going to be issues around. Look, rock and roll is about sex.
Mm.
There's no question about it.
Let's just name it.
At a certain point, women are less sexy than men because women can't have babies after they get hit menopause, and men can still have babies when they're 90.
Surely that's when they get more sexy.
What, women?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I agree.
But you're forgetting, you know, basic human
evolutionary
DNA
biology,
evolutionary biology and our basic instinct to continue as a human species. So, you know, it boils down to something incredibly, you know, that's just written in our DNA. It's very, very unconscious. And, you know, you have to kind of, and I always wanted, as a musician, I always wanted to kind of push through that ceiling and just say, you know, it doesn't matter. But I think there are issues that are beyond, and you have to keep making really good music. And the people that you mentioned, Chrissy Hynde and Debbie Harry and Lucinda Williams, and they may continue to make good music. And I believe if you continue to make good music, you can get past that. And I think that's, you know, what Rebecca and I are doing.
But I think it's harder to get your music heard when you're in your 50s, like you and I are.
And marketed.
And people, it's your old fans that always stick by you and they'll buy anything you put out, even if it's crap, do you think?
Well, I also think there's another really basic thing about biology here, and human beings, when they form those first imprints of music, they're the most powerful musical memories of their life. And they continue to kind of want to go back to those because they are associated with times of their life that they're very fond of. It's nostalgia. Mm. It's so deep and it's so powerful.
It's
very difficult to get new fans when you're older. And that's men and women alike. There's nothing to do with gender here.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, when you made the imprint on people who, you know, were living those things at the time, and their youth and the summer and having their first relationships and rebelling
you're
against their parents and making their first
nostalgia.
Decisions and it's so powerful,
isn't it?
The frustrating thing I find is that as you get older, a lot of the time you get better at what you're doing. Like I'm much better. I'm a much more confident songwriter now. I'm not trying to cater for anyone, you know, that the beauty of just getting into the flow state and hopefully something good will come of it. And I don't stress so much over, well, will they like it? Will they understand that line? Is that too ambiguous? Is this, blah, 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 you know, getting into this self-doubt sort of spin, which a lot of artists do. I think all that sort of gets pushed aside a bit as you get older, which is really liberating, yet you're not getting as much attention. Well, Deborah maybe is, but...
I'm doing crazy things like running a festival.
Well, that's coming
up
this week. Is that not coming up this weekend in Melbourne?
It is. So on the 6th of September, and Rebecca is playing. Rebecca is going to play. I should. Wait a minute. Hang on a second. I'll get to that bit. But we are holding. Willie and I are have put a lot of time into putting together a Jewish music festival, which will run on the 6th of September in Elsternwick at the Classic Cinemas and a marquee set up on Gordon Street in the Kadima Hall. And basically, what it is WOMAD and Byron Bay Blues Festival and Port Ferry all rolled into one, indoors, heated, seated, no queues at the bar because Jews don't drink much, and everybody looks like Gary David from the back. I mean, it's the perfect day, really, and it's a fraction of the cost. But anyway. Anyway, so
that's this
there's
Sunday
some really fantastic bands on. I would encourage everybody who's listening to this program to get online and look at Sheer Madness, and that's
Sheer
spelled S-H-I. That's a great summary of my life in the last year.
SHIRmadness.com.
At any rate, what I was going to say was, we've got this concert called Song of Songs where we've invited our favourite Melbourne performers to pick a favourite song by a Jewish composer and perform it. And Rebecca has picked
what have you
the
picked?
Best Jewish song of all time. It's the best song of all
which
time,
is,
really, isn't
Rebecca?
It? Oh, I don't know we can tell you, but you can hint.
Oh, no.
You can hint.
Okay, I've got two words to say. Judy Garland.
Oh.
That's the hint.
Oh, look, there was so much more I wanted to talk about because, of course, your kids are both now performing with you in different ways as well, which raises interesting themes from the film too. And also you've both performed with partners in different ways to mix success. Obviously it's working for you and Deb and Willie, but we've run it right out of time.
But not for
What are you trying to say, Natasha?
So much more to talk about.
I know. I mean, the thing about Rebecca and I, we've both mixed our genes with other musical genes to produce extraordinary offspring who I think will be, you know, part of the next generation of great music makers.
Watching out for your 20-year-old daughter, Sid, Deb, and Harry, your son, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
That's lovely, a pleasure, Natasha.
Thanks, Natasha.
And we go and see the film, Ricky and the Flash. More themes, artistic and musical, coming up with Michael Cathcart straight after the news. Hi there.
Good morning. Yes, talking of genes or mixing your genes, Richard Glover joins us.
Oh, well, yes, his wonderful memoir.
Well known to listeners in Sydney and readers of the Sydney Morning Herald in Sydney. He's written an incredibly candid book called Flesh Wounds, all about his, well, how can I put this tactfully, his very, very odd parents.
Yes, well, join the club. Michael Cathcart coming up straight after the news with Richard Glover and his incredible memoir. Coming up to the news, 10 a.m. Thank you for your company. Bye.